I'm going to be telling you about four surprises that have come from genetic studies of the past that I've been involved in some way in. Most of this work has been work in which I've been intensely involved. I'm also going to summarize a little bit of work done by others. So I think that if you come away from this talk with two findings, please let me know if I'm speaking too quickly one of them is that population history is profoundly surprising. When we're able to use DNA to look into the past, it's very different often from how we thought it was. And that the other is that we're all mixed again and again in the past, and that no one is really pure in any sense. So most of my talk is going to be about a new scientific instrument, which was really came online in a serious way only in about 2010. And the scientific instrument is the ability to extract DNA from ancient human remains or remains of other animals or plants, and to obtain sequence data from it on the scale of the whole genome, the great majority of our DNA. And while ancient DNA has been around as a field for about 35 years now, it really is what happened in 2010 that's made it very important as a way of studying the past. And I'm talking about it as a new scientific instrument to highlight, to draw the analogy or to suggest the analogy to past scientific instruments in the past that have made a great difference in our understanding of the world around us, such as microscopes several centuries ago or telescopes. They provide the ability to look at things that have not been looked at before, and the measure of how surprising a new scientific and how useful a new scientific instrument is how surprising the results are when it's turned into an area that's not been turned to before, and how it's surprising it reveals the surprises it reveals about that. So in ancient DNA, and briefly to summarize, starts with an ancient remain, like a bone. This is a temporal bone. It's a piece of the skull containing the inner ear region in a clean room where the goal is to protect the sample from the people handling it. We isolate a part of the bone that we think is cleanest and has the least contamination and the highest density of DNA. It's a kind of miracle that DNA is a stable molecule that in bone preserves for a remarkably long time, many tens of thousands of years in some cases even more than 100,000 years, and can be extracted and sequenced. So we isolate the particular part of the bone that we're interested in. This is the cochlea, the otic capsule of the inner ear that we grind it or mill it into a powder. We dissolve the powder in a solution that removes the bone and the mineral content and that removes the proteins. And then we turn it into a form that can be sequenced in one of these sequencing machines. These sequencing machines began to be developed about and become available widely about one decade ago and have made DNA sequencing about 1 million times cheaper per unit of DNA sequence than was the case about 20 years ago when the human genome was sequenced for the first time. And that's made it possible to obtain large amounts of data. That was one of the several innovations that made it possible to obtain large amounts of data from ancient human remains. Ancient human remains, the DNA, while present, is very small fragments. And the way that we used to get at it was through polymerase chain reaction, PCR, which requires sacrificing about 35 or 40 of the DNA letters of the sequence just in order to study it. And so the methods before really lost most of the material just by trying to amplify it. Now with new sequencing methods, we can take the whole ancient fragments, which might typically be 40 or 50 DNA letters long, and study them entirely. So it opens, it's not just much more sequencing, but it also allows us to access the vast majority of the DNA that's been preserved. So what happened since 2010, this is a measurement of the number of whole genome data sets from humans that have been published to date. And you see there's a very dramatic change. The first five whole genome data sets were published in 2010, and that was quite revolutionary. I'll tell you shortly about some of the results from 2010. They included four archaic humans and one modern human. But since 2013, there's been a 100-fold increase in the number of genome sequences. In my laboratory, for example, we actually have internally an additional 5,000 genome sequences, most of which have been produced in the last year or two, and I know it's the same in several other laboratories. So the growth of this field is very, very rapid, and it, with the increase in amount of data, it's possible to ask questions about the past that simply were not able to answer before. Just like with the microscope, when you increase the resolution of the image by a factor of 10 or a factor of 100, each time you see things that were not possible to see before. And I'll give you some examples of that. So I'm going to briefly talk about how our genetic material reveals the past. So especially with Molly's talk before, and I'm not sure of the background of much of the audience, I may be saying something that all of you know, but I'm just going to briefly review it anyway. The DNA that we're studying here, and I'm going to be telling you not so much about biology in this talk, but about history, using the DNA as a tool to learn about the past, but I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the biology that we use to do this. So a human cell, the great majority of cells in the human body, have within them about 3.2 billion DNA letters, actually twice that, because you get a copy of your genome from your mother and a copy from your father. And the DNA letters are strung out along 23 pairs of packages called chromosomes that are in the nuclei of the cells. So here's a blow-up on the cartoon of a pair of chromosomes, and then a blow-up of a little segment showing the DNA double helix, which is a string of these DNA letters. I'm not going to talk about any details of molecular biology now after this point. So what we do to learn about the past is to study the mutational differences that exist between these strings of DNA letters, these four DNA letters, adenine, cytosine, thymines, and guanines. The great majority of the DNA letters between all of our genome sequences are identical at the parts that we can line up. So at the parts of our genome sequences that we can line up, they're about 99.9% similar. They're actually quite similar also to chimpanzees. We're about 99% similar to chimpanzees, our closest living relatives. But those differences that occur about one every 1,000 positions in the DNA letters, because the DNA is so long, about 3.2 billion letters long, there's millions of them. And with those letters, we can learn about history. Here's an example of that. So if you look between your mother and father's DNA sequences in this stretch, there might only be two places over a very long stretch where there are differences. That reflects the fact that there's not been much time for mutations to accumulate since your mother and father share a common ancestor at that section of the genome. They might have a relative 10th generations in the past, 10 generations in the past when they share a common ancestor. It's telling you they're closely related at that point. On the other hand, there's places which are packed full of mutations, differences between the DNA letters, and those reflect accidents of copying of DNA that have accumulated at, we think, a pretty constant rate over time, adjusting for different contexts in the DNA sequence. And the time here might be more like the average in the genome. The average time to the common ancestor between two DNA sequences is probably about 1 to 2 million years in humans. That's the depth of our human variation, and it goes back even further in many places. So I wanted to sort of also tell you about the type of information you're getting from your genome sequence. Before 2010, ancient DNA studies primarily looked at the mitochondrial DNA. This is a little bit of your DNA. It's about 16,500 DNA letters long that's packed into an organelle, an energy-producing organelle of your cell. There's typically about 1,000 of those mitochondrial DNAs per cell. They have a specific function, and because they exist in such a high copy number, they're easier to study with DNA analysis. You have a higher chance of being successfully going to study them. And that's what was the workhorse of ancient DNA analysis prior to this revolution. The mitochondrial DNA is almost entirely transmitted by eggs to their offspring, so you almost always get it from your mother, and she gets it in turn from her mother. And so the differences that have accumulated in it reflect the maternal history, the history of mothers, 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 mothers. And so a lot of the studies about the past, for example, the finding in 1987 that all people today carry a mitochondrial DNA sequence that descends from a common ancestor maybe 160,000 years ago or so in Africa, that was based on the mitochondrial DNA. But of course, you should remember that it traces only one line in the past, your mother's 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 mother, a very important line, but your mother's mother's father's line is just as important. So if you actually look at how many ancestors your DNA gets scattered into every generation in the past, you might think that you have two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents, so there's a doubling every generation, 16, 32, 64 over here. But actually what's happening is that your DNA is packaged into these chromosomes, these chunks of DNA. So you have 23 pairs, so 23 times 2 is 46, plus your mitochondrial DNA, that's 47. And every time there's a generational change, your mother makes an egg or your father makes a sperm, they splice together bits of the DNA they got from their own parents, men maybe about 25 or 27 times, I think, women about almost twice that, altogether it's about 70 new splicings every generation. So your 47 fragments that you carry one generation ago existed on that plus about 70 fragments, maybe 118. So you add about 70 fragments back per generation, so it increases additively, 118, 189, 260, and so on. By the time you get back to 10 generations, there's fewer fragments which are ancestral to your genome than ancestors. What that means is that the chunks of your DNA are getting diluted into a very large number of ancestors, and at some point more than 10 generations back, you actually don't inherit DNA from many of your ancestors. And 15 generations back, the number of ancestors who are your real genealogical ancestor, your mother's father's father's mother, etc., actually the great majority of them have not contributed any DNA at all to you, even though they're genuinely related to you genealogically, just because the additive process of shattering of your genome going back into past and ancestors doesn't keep up with the exponential growth in the number of those ancestors. Of course, you don't really have 32,000 ancestors. Some of them are the same, so that's another process that's going on that I don't show here. But the important thing to realize is that each of these fragments of DNA is scattered into a different ancestor. And so you're not one person when you sequence your DNA. You're a multitude of fragments of DNA, each of which provides an independent or semi-independent query about the history of the ancestors who led to you. So sometimes when people think of a DNA sequence, they think it is just a single sample, kind of like mitochondrial DNA, but in fact, you're many, many samples, and you can obtain ultra-precise estimates of how you're related to other people in the world just with a single genome, and I'll show you a few examples of that. So a single person is not a single sample, a single person is a multitude, and that's why genetic data is so powerful. It makes it possible to precisely position the ancestry of each individual relative to other individuals you have for comparison. So my talk will be about four surprises that have come just in the last 10 years or 8 years mostly from the genome revolution and especially from ancient DNA. And the reason I'm couching this in terms of surprises is I hope that by the end of this talk, you will come out of this room thinking differently about the world than you came into this room, because it's telling us profoundly different things about the past than we thought we knew before. So the first surprise is work about archaic humans who lived alongside our own primary ancestors more than 40,000 years ago. If we roll back 70,000 years in time, it's very clear, combining the archaeological and the genetic data, that there were at least five, maybe more, groups that were extremely different from each other that were human, living side by side, and many of them meeting each other. We know that not just from DNA, but also from the fossil record. And today we're alone. We're pretty homogeneous. The most different pair of populations in the world today are much more similar to each other than each of these five groups. So people who are, quote, anatomically modern humans first arise in the skeletal record maybe up to 300,000 years ago, as recently documented by skeletal remains in northern Africa and Morocco, about 300,000 years ago, and in Ethiopia about 200,000 years ago, and explode out of Africa in the Near East, this region, after about 50,000 years ago, and displace the archaic humans who were established there before. Neanderthals arise maybe 400,000 years ago, and you could argue about how to start both modern humans and Neanderthals, and of course it's limited by the skeletal remains that we have, and occupied this kind of range. Maybe that range is even bigger now, and over different periods of time. Neanderthals disappeared approximately 40,000 years ago at the same time, more or less, that modern humans became established in Europe and Western Asia, and there's a period of documented overlap archaeologically. So the question was whether there had been interbreeding. The genetic data up to the time in 2010, when this work was published, found no evidence for interbreeding, and in my own education, I had been part of a group of school of people who had argued very strongly that all of the ancestry of modern humans derives from a spread out of Africa and the Near East after about 50,000 years ago, entirely displacing the archaic human forms. And I was very convinced through my background that this was so, but I had the privilege to work with Svante Paabo and colleagues who were sequencing Neanderthal DNA, and of course the question was, given that Neanderthals and modern humans must have interacted with this high-resolution data that we thought we were collecting, maybe we could test more accurately what this nature of this interaction was. So what we developed was a series of tests for whether interbreeding occurred, and the simplest one that we used, and that we've used again and again ever since about 2008, was the following test. So this is a cartoon of one of these packages of DNA, that, the chromosomes. So this is a French chromosome and a Nigerian chromosome, and this might be a position where one, the French chromosome has one DNA letter and the Nigerian chromosome has another DNA letter. And the trick we used was we realized that something that other people had realized as well, that if we compare the Nigerian and French DNA, and it's really true that the Nigerians and French descend from a common ancestral African modern human population whose ancestors separated earlier, maybe 300 or 500 or 700,000 years ago, or even a million years ago from Neanderthals, then it should be very much the case that Neanderthals should match the Nigerian sequence or the French sequence equally often within statistical resolution. So we could measure that with our genome sequence, and we found that there were more matches of the Neanderthal to the French sequence than to the Nigerian sequence. And this was a highly statistically significant observation. It couldn't occur by chance. And through a series of additional analyses in this study and in subsequent studies, we and others established that this was definitively due to interbreeding, where Neanderthals interbred with modern humans. And we now know that much of that occurred in a relatively tightly known time frame between about 54 and 49,000 years ago in the common ancestry of nearly all people today who carry this ancestry. It's now beginning to be clear that there's additional small contributions of Neanderthal ancestry, especially to early modern humans. For example, an individual from 40,000 years ago who we were involved in studying, who carried a Neanderthal ancestry 4 to 6 generations back in their past. That must have been an additional Neanderthal encounter. But the main one that contributed to people living today is this somewhat earlier one between about 54 to 49,000 years ago. So having established that, we next carried out a similar analysis where instead of a Nigerian and a French individual, we had a Nigerian and a second Neanderthal. And we asked how much of the way is this French person to the skew you would expect if you replaced them with a full Neanderthal in this analysis. And they were about 2% of the way toward being a full Neanderthal by this analysis. And this is a valid way to estimate the proportion of DNA from a non-African person that comes from Neanderthals. And it's about 2% in all non-Africans. It's a little bit and significantly higher, we think, in East Asians than in Europeans. The reason being that after about 8,000 years ago, Europeans had a dilution of their Neanderthal DNA due to mixture into Europe of farmers coming from the Near East who had some of their ancestry from a group which had not experienced Neanderthal ancestry in its history, its deep history. The second example I wanted to show you in 2010 was how DNA can be a real surprise. So late in the 2000s, a group of archaeologists working in Denisova Cave in the Altai Mountains of southern Siberia came across a pinky bone, which was that little corresponds to that piece of the finger. It was a tiny bone. They were able to identify that it was human, but they didn't know what type of human it was from. They thought it might be a modern human. They thought it might be a Neanderthal. And it was sent to Pabo's lab in Germany, in Leipzig, for sequencing. It turned out that when it was sequenced, the time to the common ancestor, so this is time, these are modern humans, these are the Neanderthals that had been sequenced up to that time, its time to the common ancestor with the Neanderthals was almost as deep as the time to the common ancestor of both with modern humans. So this was clearly not a Neanderthal, it was a different group entirely. And so what it was an example of was very different from what had happened with Neanderthals, and it really let the genie out of the bottle from the point of view of DNA. Prior to this, what had propelled the work in Neanderthal studies was the extraordinary archaeological record of Neanderthals. An incredible amount was known from 150,000 years of study of Neanderthals. A lot was known about their culture, from the tools they made, from the studies of their skeletons, the distribution of where they lived. But with these Denisovans, they were not even expected. This group is a cousin of Neanderthals. All these groups, modern humans and Neanderthals, had big brains about the same size. They made sophisticated tools. But there was no well-worked-out archaeology, set of skeletons that were unified in a coherent group corresponding to these Denisovans. And yet we now know that they were a more diverse group, actually, than Neanderthals. And so this is a case where it's a genome propelling search for archaeological association to it. There had not been a well-established understanding in Eastern Asia and Southeast Asia, whereas I'm about to show you these people had an impact as well, that there was a group that was plausibly a cousin of Neanderthals. I think that was not a commonly accepted idea. So this is an example where the DNA studies created a new observation that propels work in other fields. So we did the same thing with this Denisova genome that we did with modern human genomes. We asked whether they matched some people today more than others, and we found what to us was another amazing surprise. So if we take this sequence from this archaic human and we see whether it matches people from New Guinea or people from China more, but you could replace Chinese people here with Europeans and many other non-New Guinean groups, you find that there's a significantly greater match rate to New Guineans than to East Asians. And this corresponds to maybe 4 to 6% of the DNA of New Guineans today deriving from people related to this ancient genome from Siberia. So this was another big surprise. Not only did this group exist, but it contributed significantly, in fact, even more significantly, to some people today than Neanderthals have. And here's a map that we subsequently worked out of where the Denisovan ancestry is distributed. So if 5% corresponds to what you see in New Guinea, this is how much of the way to 5% all these groups have. So maybe there's about 0.2% in much of East Asia and South Asia. There's almost nothing in Europe and Africa, and there's the most in New Guinea and populations nearby in Australia and groups that New Guineans or people related to them contributed to. So it suggests there was a mixture of a group that's related to Denisovans into these groups. Now, of course, it's a bit strange that the highest proportion of this ancestry is so far from Siberia. And in fact, if you study the ancestry from Denisovans in this individual, it's not closely related to the Siberian Denisovan. It's from a group that itself is separated by hundreds of thousands of years. So this, in fact, shows through the ancient DNA that there's actually a third group or a fourth group that we didn't know about before, which you might call Australo-Denisovans or something, another Denisovan group that interbred with modern humans, which was more different from these Denisovans than the most different pair of human populations are today. And perhaps given that, it's not so surprising that some of them would be on the route that people took to get into this part of the world. So what this ancient work has done, and there's been extraordinary work that's come out of this continued study since that time, this is where we were in 2014, has documented a series of archaic lineages, such as the Denisovans, such as these Australo-Denisovans, this deeply splitting population that we did not know about before. It's even found unknown lineages that have left traces of mixture in Denisovans and other archaic humans, perhaps a mixture from the modern human lineage into the Neanderthal lineages quite deep in time, although that's still controversial, and mixtures amongst these groups. So what it's showing is a much more complex history of many lineages we didn't know about and mixtures between them, and it documents and reveals a complexity in our history which perhaps we didn't know about. Just last year, in work I wasn't involved in, this Denisova cave, which keeps yielding additional Denisovans as well as Neanderthals, yielded an individual who was a first-generation mixture of a Neanderthal mother and a Denisovan father. So this was a first-generation mixture. In the DNA that we're seeing from people at the time of contact of these groups, a large fraction of them, a substantial proportion of them, are actually first-generation mixtures in this case, or fourth- or sixth-generation case mixtures in the case of this Romanian person who lived about 40,000 years ago, and additional cases as well. It's clear that mixture between these extremely different groups was occurring commonly again and again when these people had the opportunity to meet, so often, indeed, that it's surprising that the degree of isolation that we actually in practice see in many of these groups was able to exist. So perhaps it was occurring in places like Denisova Cave, where the ranges overlapped. Maybe it was a kind of hybrid zone, like you sometimes see in Central Europe with mice, for example, where in Czechoslovakia, for example, Czechia, you see mixture of Western and Eastern European mice, and there you see many recent mixtures of Western and Eastern groups. Maybe Denisova Cave was a place like that, and maybe some other groups of humans and the ones that contributed more to people today, for example, might have been from other parts of Europe where there weren't these overlaps. So it's interesting to think about these hybrid zones and that the frequency of humans mixing with other people when they encountered each other in the deep past, much more different from each other than people are today. Second surprise, this is related to what Molly talked about, and this will be a short little section of my talk. I just wanted to talk about the evidence about key genetic changes. I think Molly's talk must have set you up for this a little bit. So I think that the archaeological observations and anthropological observations have documented that prior to the rise of modern humans and Neanderthals, there was a perhaps tripling of the brain size of humans compared to our ape ancestors. And between 100 to 50,000 years ago, there is a quickening of evidence of, quote, modern human behavior, whatever that means. But perhaps that means increased use of symbolic behavior, art, use of art, more diverse tool making, more innovative change in the archaeological record. And so this sort of observation prompted some people, such as Richard Klein, in the late 80s to propose the idea of a genetic switch. Maybe, I think it was at a time of almost euphoria about DNA, that DNA would not only allow us to find a common ancestor in Africa, DNA not only solves the genetic code in such a simple and beautiful way, but maybe it will even explain how modern humans came to be so special. I don't know if we are special, but the idea that we might be special. And so there was the idea that maybe in this time something special happened, some genetic change, perhaps a little bit before this, rose to high frequency and became fixed in the population so that everybody had it, and it made possible behaviors that were not possible before. So that's just a restatement of what I said. So in work that we published in 2016, we tried to look through analysis, not of ancient genomes, but of modern genomes, about whether there was any place in our DNA that plausibly could house a genetic switch. So if you think there might have been a key single or a small number of changes that did something very important, maybe they allowed the use of conceptual language or some kind of special thing, I don't know, in your brain. So maybe what that you would expect, perhaps, is that sometime before this great innovative period, 50 to 100,000 years ago, but not too much before, there would have been the occurrence of this mutation, and because it was so advantageous in that population with the culture that must have existed in that population under this model, it would have risen to high frequency under extreme pressure of natural selection, such that everybody had it, and everybody today, or nearly everybody, would have it. And so what we did is we used this trick that I mentioned to you before of looking at places in the genome where there are few differences compared to more differences. And you can look right across a DNA sequence, for example, one of these whole chromosome packages. This is one person, this is another, and you're looking at the time to the common ancestor on the y-axis between the mother's and father's sequence. And you see this is a person who their mother and father have a recent common ancestor over this stretch, and then more typical 1 or 2 million common ancestors. Here's a second person. So we took 40 very diverse people around the world, all from all different places, and we looked at all across the genome for the deepest ancestor of anybody that we saw. And that would tell us the time to the common ancestor of everybody, or something close to the time of common ancestor of everybody. And here is the result. So this is thousands of years ago on a logarithmic plot. So if you actually look at it, most of the genome, the average time since everybody, all 40 of these pairs of people genomes share a common ancestor is maybe 2 million years ago or so. But there's no density of this plot below about 300,000 years ago. This big change in human behavior happened between 100 and 50,000 years ago, which is hundreds of thousands of years after the most extreme place we analyzed where everybody shares a common ancestor. So that's telling you that at least in the parts of the DNA we surveyed, which was about 80 or 70% of the lining upable sequence of the genome, we couldn't find anything close to a place where a single mutation arose 100,000 years ago, 150,000 years ago, due to a new mutation and rose to high frequency in everybody. If such a thing had occurred, everybody would share a common ancestor 150,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago, but we see nothing even close. So what that's telling you is that there's very little room for a key change, and instead there must be some other basis for modern human behavior. My own guess is that it's mostly culturally driven, and if genetics has any contribution to it at all, it's just a slow adaptation process to cultural needs that have changed over time. But genetics not being in the driver's seat, in my opinion, in forming these key innovations. But that's very speculative, the last few things I just said. In any case, there's no evidence genetically for a genetic switch. Another observation here is that if you look at the time of diversification of present-day human groups, the most separated pairs of human groups, for example, Khoisan from Southern Africa and West Africans, separated about 200,000 years ago substantially or more. But these changes happened well after that. So if you think there's key changes that occurred in this period, they would have had to occur some populations much more than in others. And yet all people today are able to master everything and succeed in everything. And so it's hard for that reason as well to imagine that it's some key unique change that arose in one group and spread around all human groups ancestral to people today. Third surprise. This is that white people, people from this part of the world, from the Near East, from Iran, and from Central Asia, have not been like we are today for a long time. So if you look 10,000 years ago in ancient DNA, this is a paper we published in 2016, there were four groups in Western Eurasia, the place where today people are rather genetically similar to each other. So if you take people in this region today, so this is Iberia, Anatolia, so on. If you look at this region today, the average level of genetic difference between pairs of individuals, as measured by the frequency differences between pairs of populations, average difference between pairs of populations, as measured by the frequency differences, say between people in Iberia and people in Russia, or people in Iberia and people in the Near East, is 10 times less by the conventional genetic measure of that than between Europeans and East Asians. That's a lot less. And today, at that time, though, there were four groups in this region: Western European hunter-gatherers, because farming had not yet arrived there; Eastern European hunter-gatherers; Iranian early farmers; and Levantine early farmers. Each of them is different from each other, as Europeans and East Asians are today. So if you were to go back in time to a time machine, if you could do that, and we can with ancient DNA, you would find a population structure in Eurasia profoundly different and almost unrecognizable compared to the one we live in today. So if you think about the world around you today and have an intuitive sense of how we're all related to each other, that's wrong even for the relatively recent past. So at that time, if you actually look at the genetic variants that code for some of the trivial, superficial traits that that we see in some Europeans today, for example, blue eyes, blonde hair, and light skin, the blue eyes actually are almost exclusively in Western European hunter-gatherers, but their skin genetically, from what we can read off from the genome, was actually very dark, and the gene for classic European blonde hair was not yet present in that population. If we look at 17,000-year-old hunter-gatherers from Siberia, that's the first occurrence of the blonde hair variant, and it probably comes in through this Eastern European hunter-gatherer population, which was there 8,000 years ago. The light skin is most likely to be coming in from European farmers, and it's that coming together of these populations that forms this look that we have today, which is typical of these populations. And so just in that trivial, superficial way, it gives you an illustration of how the Europe in the past and West Eurasia in the past is profoundly different from how it is today. So how did this situation transform into the situation we find ourselves in today? Well, we know that too from the ancient DNA. By 6,000 years ago, if you take these bars as proportions of ancestry from these four sources, they had mixed with each other. It's not as if any of these ancestry sources disappeared or went extinct or were largely displaced the way that happened with Neanderthals as modern humans moved into their territory. They all contributed a lot to later people in this region. And it's that mixing that has reduced the differentiation. By 6,000 years ago, the level of differentiation was three times less than it was a few thousand years before. And by 4,000 years ago, the onset of the Bronze Age, which is a profoundly transformative event that I'll tell you about more shortly, the level of differentiation was similar to what we see today. And for the first time genetically, you see people with the characteristic of mixtures of ancestry that are common across all of these regions today. That's when you see a population structure like resembling roughly what you see in this part of the world today. So I'm going to now continue this part of my talk by asking the question, are cultural changes propelled by movement of people? So ancient DNA allows us to ask that. In archaeology, prior to the advent of genetic data, there was always a big question. When you see, for example, a transformation of the type of material remains that people left behind, changes in the ceramic types, the pots people make, or the type of tools people made, similarities between these in very different places that suddenly appear, is that due to the spread of a technology like a cell phone type invented somewhere in East Asia to different parts of the world? Or is it due to actually movements of people carrying that technology into a new place? There's two big cultural pieces of evidence in the last 10,000 years that I'm highlighting here. One is the spread of farming. So farming explodes into Europe after about 8,500 years ago from the Near East, where it was first developed about 11 to 12,000 years ago. It first arrives in the Balkans in Greece about 8,500 years ago and then spreads along different well-documented routes across the Mediterranean and into Central Europe by about 1,000 years ago, reaching Britain and Scandinavia about 6,000 years ago. So that's cultural evidence of a profound change, and there's been a great debate in archaeology about to what extent that was propelled by movement of people or the local hunter-gatherers copying the technology from their neighbors. The other piece of evidence culturally is the one that comes from languages. Today in Europe, the great majority of languages, with really interesting, a few exceptions that are profoundly interesting, are extremely similar to each other. They're in the family called Indo-European languages. And this was noticed several centuries ago and articulated, for example, by William Jones, who wrote, and I'm going to read the quote, "The Sanskrit language, that is the ritual language of northern India. Whatever may be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of the verbs and in the form of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident, so strong indeed that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists. William Jones was not the first to observe this, but he articulated this in a particularly clear way, and it came from him studying Greek and Latin as a school child in Britain, and then coming to India as a judge or as a jurist, and out of a hobby studying Sanskrit and realizing that the language had remarkable similarities. So the question is, can we actually answer with DNA the question about whether these similarities of culture, for example, in Europe and between Europe and South Asia, or similar spread of farming, to what extent was movements of people propelling that? That was an unanswerable question before DNA. People have tried to answer that question with skeletal remains, but there have been challenges to interpreting, for example, the shapes of skulls as evidence of population movement, because those are plastic. They can be affected by the diets people eat, the way you chew, and they're not, there's a limited number of measurements you can make. But with genetics, you can measure hundreds of thousands, or at least tens of thousands of independent places in the DNA, as I told you about before, and obtained ultra-high resolution measurements of how people are related to each other. And so that's what it's possible to do. So now, for the first time, we can go back to ancient skeletal remains and ask how they're related to each other and to people today. And we can just address these long-standing questions about whether these many changes documented in the archaeological record are due to movements of people and when they're not. And the answer is sometimes one and sometimes the other. And the patterns are profoundly different sometimes than has been the consensus in archaeology. I could give you a couple of examples of that, and then I'll finish my talk. So these bar plots, again, show the proportion of ancestry. And this is the situation we were in 2014 in ancient DNA. All of the ancient DNA we had from Europe, essentially, was prior to 5,000 years ago. And all the samples we had were mostly farmer from between 8,000 and 5,000 years ago, this dark blue. And sometimes they had some hunter-gatherer ancestry. The history of farming movement into Europe was that it was largely a displacement, overall about an 80% population replacement of the local hunter-gatherer population, but with mixture that occurred, overall contributing about 20% by about 5,000 years ago. The proportions varied in different parts of Europe, especially high hunter-gatherer ancestry in southwestern Europe, in Iberia, especially low in southeastern Europe. But today, already in 2014, we knew that, in fact, there's a major ancestry type that was not present 5,000 years ago. So we knew it must have entered sometime in that period. So in 2012, my colleagues and I, not using ancient DNA, had made the following observation. We had developed a new statistical test, which was very simple, like a lot of the tests my colleagues and I develop, for whether populations are mixed. And the way it works is as follows. So we take a DNA sequence location, a place where people vary. Some people might have a thymine, one of the DNA letters. Some people might have an adenine, another DNA letters. And these pie charts are showing the frequency in a population, like French, of the thymine type. So it might be 50% in this case. And you can ask the question over hundreds of thousands of places in the genome where you make these measurements, on average, do the French have an intermediate frequency between a Native American population, say from South America, and a Sardinian population? And if they, on average, are intermediate, it's possible to prove that they must be mixed of two populations related differently to Native Americans and Sardinians. Not necessarily Native Americans and Sardinians themselves, but two groups that are differently related to those two groups. And so with this test in hand, we took data from about 50 populations around the world where we had frequency measurements at hundreds of thousands of positions. And for each of these 50 or so populations, we took each other possible pair of populations and tested whether this test population was a mixture of groups related differently to those other pairs. And for Northern Europeans, including especially French, was the example that we were focusing on because that was a representative Northern European population we had, we found a huge signal of mixture. And the signal was maximized when one of the sources was Sardinians, a population from Southern Ireland off Southern Europe, and the other population was Native Americans. And it was definitely Native Americans. It was Native Americans much more than Siberians or South Asians or Australians. And we found this observation amazing and baffling. And so what we predicted, of course, was not that Native Americans sailed across the Atlantic to contribute to Europeans, because that seemed unlikely based on the archaeology, but a more sober scenario where what happened is that there was a population that once lived in northern Eurasia. We called them the ancestral North Eurasians. We didn't have any DNA from them, and we didn't think they had any direct descendants today, but that their descendants crossed into the Americas and contributed to Native Americans sometime before 15,000 years ago, and some other of their descendants went into and contributed to Europeans who also had ancestry perhaps from farmers coming in from the Near East. So we called this group the ancient North Eurasians. What we were proposing was what we now call a ghost population, a population that no longer exists in unmixed form, but that we reconstruct statistically based on people who are living today. And so in 2013, a paper by a group in Copenhagen obtained DNA from a 24,000-year-old individual in the shores of Lake Baikal in Siberia. And this individual, as shown in this heat map here, had affinity both to Native Americans, you see the strong red, and to Europeans, but very little affinity to people in that part of the world today. The reason being, as we now know from further ancient DNA, that there have been large-scale movements after the end of the last ice age into this region from the south, displacing the previously established population. So this ghost was found in ancient DNA, and with the ghost in hand, it was possible to do much more. So now I'm going to summarize a series of studies by us and others since 2014 that have described what happened over time in Western Eurasia through DNA. So what you're seeing here is 1,000 points approximately from the locations shown here. This is a map of Europe, North Africa, and the Near East. And the data that's being visualized here is the following. So as before, what we're looking at is data from each individual from about 600,000 places in our DNA where people vary. And we're looking, so you should think of the data as a table with about 600,000 rows and about 1,000 columns corresponding to the about 1,000 people we're analyzing. And in each cell of the table, there is a 0, 1, or 2, depending on whether you have 0, 1, or 2 copies of, for example, a thymine, one of the four DNA letters. You multiply the matrix by itself to get a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix that measures over all of these hundreds of thousands of places how closely related each individual is to every other individual. So you end up with a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix table of how closely related people are. And then you apply a mathematical technique known as principal components analysis to most efficiently separate each of these 1,000 samples from each other and plot them. So on the x-axis here is the most efficient way of separating the samples, and on the y-axis is the second most efficient way of separating the samples. And there's a third axis and a fourth axis that you can't plot in a two-dimensional plot. And what you immediately see is an amazing structure where the Europeans are all on the left, the Near Easterners are all on the right, and there's largely a gap in between, mostly filled by populations of known more recent contact between Europe and the Near East, Jewish populations of different types, and island Mediterranean populations. At the bottom of the plot are southern Mediterranean groups from the Levant in the Near East, from Sardinia in Europe, and at the top are northern European groups and northern Caucasus groups. So this is a remarkable pattern. Now I'm going to make all these dots gray. So it's the same set of dots, they're gray, and I'm going to show you where the ancient samples fall moving forward in time. So the hunter-gatherers of Europe before farmers arrive fall beyond Europe in the direction of European differentiation from the Near East. The correct interpretation of that is that Europeans today are a mixture of this lost population and people like this. The first farmers fall over there on top of where present-day Sardinians fall. The correct interpretation of that is that Sardinians today have a pretty high proportion of ancestry from the first farmers. They've been relatively isolated on this island with relatively little subsequent impact from some of the later events that have contributed ancestry. You see more in northern Europeans. Meanwhile, in far eastern Europe, about 5,000 years ago, this population forms. That is a mixture of Eastern European hunter-gatherers and what we now know are Iranian or Caucasus hunter-gatherers coming from over here. They form over here, but at 5,000 years ago, you still don't yet have populations with typical ancestry of Northern Europeans. That only happens after 5,000 years ago in association with some profound transformations in the archaeological record. And the correct interpretation of this is there's a mixture of people like this and people like this and a little bit of people like this, and they form that. So in summary, Europe is massively transformed by two migrations in the last 10,000 years. The first bringing farming into Europe. That's accompanied genetically by an approximately 80% population turnover. And the second one, which was not previously appreciated, brought in this ancestry from the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas, and in some groups went to an up to 70% population turnover. And even today, some groups have about 50%, half of their ancestry from this group. In archaeology, prior to this work, the consensus had been that after farming was established, it would have been very difficult for there to be large-scale movements into Europe from elsewhere because a densely established farming population would be hard to displace. Just like the British and the Mughals had they didn't leave much genetic impact on India because it was a dense population. Why should you expect something similar from thinly spread herders from the steppe to make an impact on Europe? But they did. So the genetics again shows a surprise, which is a profound transformation where a densely spread set of herders with a less efficient economic system than the local farmers instead made a tremendous impact in this region. So this is again a surprise coming from DNA. So this is one of the individuals from this group that was spread over the Black and Caspian Seas about 5,000 years ago. They're from an ancient archaeological culture called the Yamnaya. This is one of the individuals we got DNA from in 2015. And they're an extraordinary archaeological phenomenon. These people, prior to them, there were many separated, differentiated cultures in different parts of the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas. More broadly. But after them, most of them disappeared and were replaced by people with a homogeneous way of making pottery and tools. And many of the settlements disappeared. These people economically took advantage of two recent innovations, the recent invention of the wheel, which had happened only a few hundred years before, not by them, but they picked it up like a lot of other people did very quickly, and the recently domesticated horse, which may have been domesticated by them, because the first domestication seems to have been a dead-end domestication of the horse in Kazakhstan. These people used horse-drawn carts to take their supplies and water out into the dry, open steppe lands and exploit the economy, the vast majority of the area, and use the landscape much more efficiently. And they spread all the way from Hungary in Europe to the Altai Mountains on the borders of Mongolia and Siberia, displacing many of the groups that were there before. So just to show you what happened in Western Europe, we now have similar analyses in many places, but let's just first look at Britain. Last year we published this paper. And so this is a plot of data from British ancient genomes, where this is the proportion of ancestry deriving from people in Britain who are from the steppe. So, who have ancestry from the steppe. So people who derive from carry DNA from the East. This is actually not the proportion of Yamnaya ancestry, but the proportion of mainlanders, presumably from Belgium and France and points further east, that already were mixed with this ancestry. So prior to 4,500 years ago, you see no ancestry from the East. This is the proportion of that ancestry. And then suddenly, at 4,500 years ago, the last big stones of Stonehenge, one of the great megalithic monuments, go up. So it's established by people with ancestry like this, the first farmers of Britain. And then about 4,400 years ago, everybody has steppe ancestry. And it's about 90%. So it's a minimum of 90% replacement of the local population. Very suddenly, there's very little evidence for overlap. Now, this may be underestimating the degree of overlap because these people cremated, they burned their dead. So maybe we're not seeing a few graves that overlapped, but it's a permanent change. And this is what genetically people in Britain look like today. They have this mix of ancestries. So it's about a 90% population replacement. A few weeks ago, we published another paper on Iberia. So this is Spain and Portugal. And you see the same time frame from 6,000 years ago to 4,500 years ago. You see none of this ancestry. Then it hits. But there's a different pattern where there's a period of hundreds of years of overlap, and then the people with no steppe ancestry disappear at the onset of the Bronze Age. So it's different in that there's a period of overlap, and it's different in that the proportion is lower. So in Iberia, it's only 40% coming from the East, whereas in Britain, it's 90%. But I want you to notice the color of these dots. So the color of these dots refers to the Y chromosome carried by these individuals. So many of these dots have open circles, and the reason is that those are females, so we can't determine the Y chromosome, which is carried from father to son. But the filled colored circles are males, and they're colored here by the type of Y chromosome they have. Bluish colors refers to the types of Y chromosome that are present in the European farmers and hunter-gatherers, and red are the ones that were only present in these Yamnaya steppe pastoralists or people related to them. And what you see is that after 4,000 years ago, there's none of this hunter-gatherer and farmer chromosomes left. So even though it's a 40% replacement overall of the DNA, it's a nearly 100% replacement of the Y chromosomes. So what that's telling you is that the men coming in were able to successfully displace the local men in some event whose dynamics we don't understand, but it tells you there was some form of unequal or asymmetrical interaction between the incoming population. And it might tell you something about the nature of what happened in context of archaeological information. So I can end the talk here for questions, or I can talk about the last quarter of my talk. I think probably I end here because I want to keep within the hour, or whatever you think. I just don't know. I'm going to continue then. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. So the fourth surprise is about South Asia and Europe. So this is a map that I will come to later. But the DNA work also shows about how Yamnaya ancestry, this ancestry from the steppes north of the Black and Caspian Seas, not only spread west, it actually surprisingly spread east. So I'm going to tell you about that evidence. And I'll begin by rolling back in time to work that we were involved in 2019, where for the first time we began to be able to deploy whole genome sequence data, but this was modern people, not ancient people. So this is the same type of analysis I showed you before, with principal component analysis, where again we take about 600,000 places in the genome. Here's a few hundred people from South Asia, East Asians, and Europeans. And when you do this analysis, you get a different picture because different populations are involved. But we noticed a really striking pattern, which is that most people in India follow a gradient that points like an arrow toward Europeans and Central Asians. And we established that this is due to a history as follows, that people in India today can be relatively well described as a mixture in different proportions of two highly divergent ancestral populations. We thought they were as different from each other based on our ghost population reconstruction as Europeans and East Asians are, and that people in India today are mixtures in different proportions of those population and have not fully homogenized, perhaps because of the history of endogamy, restricted gene flow between groups in South Asia. We were able to correlate this proportion of ancestry related to West Eurasians, Europeans, Central Asians, and Near Easterners, to the proportion which ranged from about 20 to 80% in our analysis. We were able to correlate it to various things. People who spoke Indo-European languages, which are the languages spoken about by most of the northern people in South Asia, tend to have more West Eurasian-related ancestry. People who speak Dravidian languages, the other large family of languages in South Asia from the south for the most part, tend to have less. And that within any region, people who are of traditionally higher social status in the traditional caste system tend to have more West Eurasian ancestry, and this is a significant effect. And what that's telling you is that both the spread of language and the assignment of traditional social status are related in some way to the mixture processes of these two ancestral populations. So in our laboratory, this observation about South Asia propelled a series of technical developments, including many of the methods I told you and used in the earlier part of the talk. I will tell you about one of them right now. So for us, a big question was, when did this mixture between ancestral North Indians and ancestral South Indians occur, these two very divergent populations? We thought maybe this is related to this profound transformations of populations that we know from archaeology and culture occurred after the end of the last ice age. Of course, South Asia was not glaciated, but the environment changed dramatically, and maybe we're seeing movements and coming togethers of people at that time. Or maybe it's related to the spread of agriculture into South Asia, which comes simultaneously from the West and the East, and collides in South Asia about 5,000 years ago. Or maybe it's related to the collapse of one of the great early civilizations of the ancient world, the Indus Valley civilization or the Harappan civilization, and the rise and eastward distribution of new cultures around the Ganges River after about 4,000 years ago. So there were profound known events that we thought we might be able to distinguish among. So what we developed is a method for estimating the date when mixture occurred in a population. And we developed it specifically for this problem. So this is, again, a cartoon of two chromosomes, these packages on which your DNA is carried. The color is whether the DNA might come from ancestral South Indians, one of the two ancestral populations, or ancestral North Indians, one of the two ancestral populations. So here might be the great-great-grandparents of someone living today. Maybe they'll be mostly ancestral North Indian, some ancestral South Indian, and some who have one parent of each type. Every time you produce an egg or a sperm, you splice together the DNA of your parents. So I'm going to show it by a little white line, and you send a spliced DNA sequence to your offspring, one or two splices per chromosome per generation. Every generation, you get one or two splices, and you chop it up. And the chop size, as if you're cutting a salad, it's just constantly cutting at a certain rate, creates sizes of chunks of ancestry that you can measure, and they tell you how long it's been since the mixture process initiated. So we applied this process in South Asia, and right across India, the mixture process seemed to have begun between 4,000 to 2,000 years ago. So that put very strong evidence that this occurred associated with the end of the Indus Valley civilization and is a relatively recent event in the Bronze Age related to profound and convulsive mixture of these two highly divergent groups that occurred in that context. So the summary of this before ancient DNA is that South Asians are a mixture of two highly divergent populations, ancestral North Indians and ancestral South Indians. They mixed convulsively, as I said, between 4,000 and 2,000 years ago in a way that's related to traditional social status, caste, and the spread of Indo-European languages. Then what happened? So right now we're trying to bring to publication the following study. So this is a study of about 530 ancient genome sequences, taking advantage of this great growth in the ability to produce this data. They have the distribution shown here. The red dots are ancient genomes, and we're comparing them to these modern dots, which are modern sequences. Now you see there's very little ancient sequences in South Asia, only from northern Pakistan today, and that's related to the difficult preservation context. And the fact that we don't have DNA sequences from India itself strongly limits some of the conclusions that we can make, and much more certainly can be said through ancient DNA from this time in South Asia, which surely will be possible. So I'm going to focus just in the little, I'm going to talk about this on one site or related set of sites. So I'm going to focus on these sites of the Bactria Margiana archaeological complex. So this was an ancient civilization, contemporaneous to the Indus Valley culture and almost as old as ancient Egypt or ancient Mesopotamia, that was first discovered by Soviet archaeologists working in the 1970s in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, those countries today. And they made these large towns with sophisticated building structures and complex trade networks, including to groups in the south. And we obtained many, many samples from sites like Gonor and nearby sites that were associated with the same culture. So we had well over 100 individuals from these buried in the cemeteries in association with this and several other sites. And genetically, they're not all homogeneous. So this is a principal component analysis of the data. And I'm going to walk you through the results on this. The main cluster of individuals, and the only cluster you would have seen if you analyzed probably only a few individuals, are genetically similar to contemporary farmers we have data from Eastern Iran. So they're genetically Iranian-like. But actually, if you look harder, buried in the same cemeteries, there's lots of other people. And it's a little bit like you sample in a city like Paris, where if you sampled five people, you might see mostly people the same. But if you sampled 40 people, you would see an extraordinary diverse group of people, and that would tell you something profound about the nature of the city. It would tell you that it's a cosmopolitan place, and it would tell you where the people are coming from, and it would tell you something about the history of places that this city has been connected to. And this is what you see in Gonor 4,000 years ago. So firstly, you see these people. These people are before 4,000 years ago, and they're genetically similar to hunter-gatherers from the north. And what we think we're seeing is evidence of cultural interaction and incorporation of hunter-gatherers from the north into this population. And we can also see from cultural and archaeological evidence that they were interacting with each other. After 4,000 years ago, you see people like this. These people have ancestry ultimately from the Yamnaya, the same people who got to Europe, and they only arrived there 4,000 years ago. At this site and at neighboring sites in Kazakhstan, you suddenly see this Yamnaya ancestry coming through about 4,000 years ago. And this puts a time when it reached this part of the world. And then finally, you see these individuals. We found a girl in a pot about 2 years ago, and we sequenced her genome, and we realized she had South Asian ancestry that had come up into this site. So we stopped our paper, and we actually spent another year and a half working on it. We found two more individuals as we got more data from this site, and then we got a second site from eastern Iran that had eight more individuals like this. And these people have a distinctive mixture of South Asian ancestry, similar to what you see in southern India today, and a type of the rest of their ancestry being a type of Iranian ancestry, but not like this, a different type. And so what we were seeing was a different population that we speculate is our immigrants from the south and the east. So these sites, Gonor and also the other site we analyzed, are in cultural contact with the Indus Valley civilization, which is this great civilization of the Indus Valley in South Asia. And we think these are likely, we speculate that these are immigrants from the Indus Valley civilization who track that material culture and are giving us a picture in immigrant form of what was happening in South Asia. So we formulate the following model for the origin of the gradient of ancestral North Indian and ancestral South Indian ancestry we see in South Asia. So these are the samples from these two sites that are a mixture of Iranian-related and South Asian-related ancestry. They're shown in orange here, and there's no steppe ancestry at all. Then after 3,000 years ago, we have a series of samples from northern Pakistan that fall along here. They have different proportions of mixture from this initial gradient of ancestry we see and a group that has steppe ancestry. We can use that method of looking at chunk size to know when it came into this population, and it came in 500 years before the dates of the samples we have. So that sandwiches the time of arrival of steppe ancestry into South Asia between about 4,000 years ago when we first see it at the periphery of South Asia and 3,500 years ago. So we know that this steppe ancestry, which today is up to 20% of the ancestry in South Asia today, was pumped in between 4,000 and 3,500 years ago, corresponding to the time of the decline of the Indus Valley civilization. Boop. The ancestral North Indian is statistically consistent with forming an unsampled point along this gradient. The ancestral South Indian is statistically consistent with forming an unsampled point that extends this gradient. And our interpretation is that what happens at the end of the Indus Valley civilization is that people along this gradient mix with people in peninsular India to form this group. And we know that's after the end of the Indus Valley civilization because of the dates of mixture I told you about before. It doesn't form before. The mixture here is much older when you look at these samples, and that this also occurred at the same time, and that today people in South Asia are a mixture of these two mixed groups that are in turn mixtures of previous groups. And that drives this primary gradient in South Asia. If you look at groups that don't quite fit this model, they are these groups up here. And if you color people by whether they're from groups that are traditionally priestly status and in the caste system, they tend to cluster in a highly significant way on groups that are above this line. And what that's telling you is that people who are the traditional custodians of some of the sacred texts in Hinduism also have more steppe ancestry, that's this direction, than you would expect based on the main model. And that's telling you another line of evidence beyond the similarity of language in South Asia and Europe, that it's the spread of the Yamnaya and their descendant groups that is spreading a large fraction of the Indo-European languages and the associated culture that we see today. So in summary, there's two parallel subcontinents of Eurasia, Europe, and India, and there's actually a remarkable parallel. Farming occurs for the first time in the world in the Near East 11 to 12,000 years ago. It explodes at about the same time, both west and east, into Europe from Anatolia, into South Asia from Iran. It then spreads through these two new environments over the next few thousand years. Meanwhile, the people form on the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Sea. They come to the peripheries of these two continents a little bit earlier, a little bit later in South Asia, mix with the local populations they begin to encounter, and mixtures of these mixed populations form the primary gradients in both of these peninsulas of Eurasia today, which have this same primary three ancestry description. So what happened after that? Today there's an extraordinarily high degree of population structure in India between groups, even living in the same place, three times greater than between Europe and the European groups. And this is clearly not due to social status or due to state that people live in or by language group. And the truth is that India today is not a large population, but it's many, many small populations that have been separated from each other, endogamy. So after this convulsive mixture, there's a switch to endogamy. We can estimate that the founder events are old based on the chunks of shared ancestry and their size, the same trick of size I told you about before. A little while ago, there's this book by Nicholas Dirks that argues that caste in modern India is actually an colonial invention, that the British used it as a way to govern society and strengthened it, which was only important in some parts of it, as a way of governing this region, and that it became much, much more rigid under colonial rule, and perhaps there's an extent to which that's true, but genetics shows that current distinctions amongst groups are in some cases thousands of years old, with almost no gene flow, for example, into groups like the Vaisya from Andhra Pradesh for 2,000 or 3,000 years, even though they're living right next to other groups. So genetics documents this cultural change where after 4,000 years ago, there's this profound mixture and then a profound switch to endogamy beginning at least 2,000 years ago in some groups that is intact today in some groups. It's a medical opportunity. About a third of Indians we now measure in a survey that we've been involved in doing are from groups with founder events, a relatively small number of people that give rise to a large number of people today. If you look at strong founder event populations in European ancestry, such as people from Finland or people from Jewish people who have gone through a relatively small number of people that gave rise to millions of people today that results in particular diseases that are common in these groups. If you look measure the strength of the founder event, a third of the Indian groups have stronger founder events, with some of them having millions of people. And this is not really appreciated in South Asia as an opportunity or as a way to avoid disease or to test for disease in prenatal context or other contexts. And it's clearly resulting in tens of thousands of new births every year with diseases that potentially could be avoided or better treated with this knowledge. To conclude, I think that what we're moving toward is an atlas of human variation. I think that it's very focused on Europe and Western Asia, not because those are the most important parts of the world, but that's because where this very new field started first. There's a really rapid growth of data. And I think what's one of the exciting themes of the coming years is going to be a dialogue between geneticists and archaeologists about how to integrate this disruptive technology. I think we geneticists are not really trained in archaeology. We're not trained in a lot of the areas that archaeologists have sensitivity to. And I think we don't really yet know how to speak clearly about these topics. And I think that one of the exciting things that's going to happen in the coming years is a better dialogue between these communities as this technology gets integrated. So in summary, ancient DNA is teaching us that much of what we thought we knew is wrong about the past, that we're all mixed and no one is pure. And it's an unusual field that is really exciting to be part of right now, like fields of science and some points in the past when it's so new that just scratching the surface is guaranteed to surprise. So I'm sorry I went over. I wasn't tracking the clock at the beginning and then saw the clock and saw how behind I was. So I'm very sorry. So thank you.